45 degrees. Now, if we had sun, we'd have summer back again, wouldn't we? Wow. Good afternoon, everybody. Stan Turner with you here. Yeah, it's another gray day. We're going to try and put some brightness out there in the airwaves for you today. Thank you so much for your company. Look who's with me today, huh? My partner from Monday through Friday on the All Request and Dedication Program, Mr. Shue, Tom Shue. How do you do, sir?
Oh, I'm doing so good, Stan. You just can't get rid of me.
How lucky you. I don't want to get rid of you.
Lucky guy.
How lucky we are to have you here on Saturday. My goodness sakes, the other guy, our Kyle buddy, taking the day off, huh?
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure what he's up to.
All right.
That's all right. He'll
be
back in tomorrow.
Either. You know, he's just out of here. That's okay. It's the holidays. My goodness, by the calendar, winter arrives on the 21st, but with this weather, I'm wondering if winter's already gone before it came.
Oh, it's so nice. Huh? It's so nice.
Remember how we got beat up in November? This feels pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah. People are, you know, not grousing about the temperatures. They do want some sunshine. Oh, I think it's going to be a little while before.
We complain if we don't have a white Christmas.
We do.
But this is pretty great.
Me complain, you know me better than that. I do all the time. Well, folks, 12:07 right now, you heard the man. It's 45 degrees in the Twin Cities. At the bottom of the hour today, this noon hour, we continue a tradition begun on this program just a few years ago. We have always been about storytelling here, and we have a story to share with you that, although you might have heard it, read it, or seen it before, it's one that deserves repeating. I think it'll be new to many of you. It's a story for the holidays. It's a true story about America's first wartime Christmas of the Second World War. It happened at the White House on Christmas Eve, a meeting of President Franklin Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. But the story reaches far beyond that place and that time. It reaches into our very fiber as a people. Historian and author David McCullough will tell us the story at half past the hour today. You're not going to want to miss it. First, though, well, there's an old saying. I think it comes from a Broadway musical, among other places. It says that money is like manure. You have to spread it around before it does any good. What do you think about that, Mr. Shue?
I think that's wise philosophy.
Makes some sense. Well, interesting to note that that old saying was at least one of the mantras of a Minnesota-born guy with a big heart and the unlikely name of Ignatius Aloysius O'Shaughnessy. Can you say that fast, huh?
I don't have to. All I know is the guy's a lady killer.
No. You got that mixed up. Yes, we're talking about that O'Shaughnessy, not the lady killer. The guy after whom it seems nearly half the buildings at the University of St. Thomas are named, and the Grand Auditorium at the University of St. Catherine, and buildings, at least one of them at Notre Dame University, maybe other places, foundations too. I.A. O'Shaughnessy did indeed spread it around. His wealth, that is, not the other stuff. I.A. was a legendary benefactor for education in this state and beyond, a man of great wealth and great generosity. And as a kid, at least, he was full of great mischief and great fun. Even got himself kicked out of college. How do you like, you gotta like a guy like that?
That's what I thought.
Ignatius Aloysius O'Shaughnessy is the subject of a new book by a fellow who knows the story well. Doug Hennis is vice president for university and government relations at the University of St. Thomas. And Doug is a former reporter and editor for the St. Paul Pioneer Press newspaper. You're one of us, the journalism fraternity, Mr. Hennis. Nice to see you again, Doug.
Well, nice to see you, Stan, and thank you very much for having me on today.
You jumped into academe a few years ago, didn't you? How could you leave being an ink-stained wretch after all those years?
It wasn't easy, but I had the opportunity to work for my alma mater, and I'm glad I took it.
I taught there at the University of St. Thomas. Back in the day, we called it the College of St. Thomas.
Yeah, it's changed a little bit from when I was a student and when you were a teacher there.
Right.
But it's a very good institution, and it's grown into a comprehensive university, and it still has four buildings named after Mr. O'Shaughnessy.
Right. Well, several more buildings have gone up since I left the campus there as an instructor, but it's I'm very fond of that place and made many lasting friends there. Well, your book, it's called That Great Heart, The Life of I.A. O'Shaughnessy, Oil Man and Philanthropist. What's the deal with that name, Ignatius Aloysius O'Shaughnessy? O'Shaughnessy's a fine Irish name. What about those first two?
Well, he was the son of a Stillwater bootmaker.
Yep.
And his parents, John and Mary, had 12 children, and then IA was the 13th, and as he used to joke, his mother had run out of names, so she went to the calendar of the saints and came up with Ignatius, because that's the feast day of St. Ignatius, July 31st. 1885 was his birth date. And then when he was in school, the custom back then was for you, when you were confirmed, to choose your middle name, and he chose Aloysius because there was a nun at St. Michael's School in Stillwater with that name, and he admired her, so he became Ignatius Aloysius O'Shaughnessy.
Something about Aloysius about a boy, isn't it? Stand for something like that?
It actually is a boy's name, right. But, you know, that was her... Okay. That was her name is a sister.
Before we move off the names, what's the short name? What's the nickname for a guy named Ignatius? Iggy?
Or what was he went by Iggy, or his friends called him Naish.
Naish, okay. Okay, so the 13th child of Irish immigrants, right, who landed here in Stillwater. Father was a bootmaker, right?
Yes.
Brought his trade over from the old country, and here they were. So, Stillwater born. This guy, the 13th child born, nothing unlucky about that number for this guy.
Not at all.
This man seemed to be kind of a golden boy. He was not afraid to try new things and do new things, and sometimes be, as I mentioned in the introduction, a bit mischievous. He got into some kind of trouble, right? He told a story about when trains were coming when he was a little kid. He and his playmates they go to the bridge, the trestle, and what would they do as the train was coming?
They would wait for the train to get close, and then they would kind of jump down and hang from underneath the trestle until the train went by.
Aha. Uh-huh. And Mr. O'Shaughnessy lived a long life, didn't he?
He was 88.
You wonder how, don't you? Boy, yeah. Oh boy, oh boy. And then he got into college. He was an ambitious young man, wasn't he? Hmm?
At 16, kids went to college at a younger age back then, but he went to St. John's University. He had several brothers who had gone up there as well, up in Collegeville, west of St. Cloud. And one day, a couple of the guys and he went out into the woods. They had some beer hidden. And... when they came back, they had missed Sunday Vespers.
Whoops.
And they were kicked out. So he got on the train the next day and came back to St. Paul. And he was his parents lived in Stillwater, so he was going to change trains. But he got off in downtown St. Paul. He walked 6-7 miles to St. Thomas.
This is January, right? Cold.
This is January, yeah. 1902. Yeah. And when he got to St. Thomas, which was a very, very small school, 2-3 buildings at the time, he ran into the president out on his evening walk.
Talk about serendipity. How do you do that? Here's a guy who just got kicked out of one college. He walks to the campus of another and literally runs into the president of the school. And then good things happen, don't they?
The president took him to dinner and asked him for his story, and he said that he had been kicked out of school, and the president asked him if he thought he had been dealt with fairly, and he said, absolutely. I knew the rule and the penalty. I broke the rule and got caught. They had to fire me.
Mm-hmm.
And the president appreciated his honesty and accepted him on the spot.
Wow. And I think he made him his secretary at some point.
Eventually he made him his secretary. It'd be probably what you would consider a work-study student today, helping in the office.
Okay.
But he was one of the president's secretaries, yes.
Had he taken the train back to Stillwater, he might have got his hindquarters kicked. And his life, who knows, might have taken a different course. You don't know.
You never know. Yeah. You never know if he would have gone back to college.
He might have
gone back to work, on the river in the lumber yard,
sure.
Something like that.
Might never have heard of him, huh?
Yeah.
Well, he was a standout athlete at St. John's before he got the boot, and then he hooked up with the athletic department at St. Thomas, and he did very well there, too. He was a standout athlete, was he not?
Yes, he was. He was captain of the football team. He played tackle, but back then the tackles actually ran the ball quite a bit, too, and he was the star in his senior year, the St. Thomas's win over St. John's.
Okay. Well, okay, so he was somebody to be reckoned with on the field, and academically, how did he do? Did he show great promise?
You know, I never saw a transcript.
Really?
I'm not sure.
Maybe he burned them.
I'm not sure they necessarily kept those kinds of things back then.
Well, Doug, he did graduate from St. Thomas, right?
1907.
Okay.
And he went into the insurance business with his older brother who was down in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few years of that, he moved to Dallas. He was in banking. He moved to Denver. He was in insurance. He moved to Wichita, where he helped to run a tire manufacturing company. And then he got this idea to start an oil company in 1917.
Were there many with that idea back then? He became something of a, what do they call it, a wildcatter in Oklahoma?
You know, he didn't like the term wildcatter, because wildcatters were people who went out and literally took a piece of land and started drilling. Hmm. And he started out as a refiner, and then he got into exploration and production, but he was pretty careful about tracts of land that he would lease and then explore.
Okay, he did it by the book then, but he did very well. Where he was kind of floundering around in the insurance business, he really found his calling in the oil fields, didn't he, down south?
Yep.
And this guy, unbelievable, by one reckoning here, well, during World War I, he was doing pretty well in the oil business, wasn't he, by that time?
Yep.
He was just a young guy. He was too old, wasn't he, to serve in the military?
Yep, he would have been too old.
Right.
His first refinery was in Oklahoma, northern Oklahoma, and then he bought one in the Chicago area, and he built one during the Depression in McPherson, Kansas, which is north of Wichita.
What kind of wisdom did this... In your book, you mentioned that he had what the poet Yeats called common sense, which is genius, according to Yeats. Huh? He was endowed with something special, this guy O'Shaughnessy, wasn't he?
I think he had... common sense is a good term. I think he had a natural knack for what would be successful and how to go about making that successful. He was and he was also very good at hiring the best people to run his business. He knew how to delegate. Most of the time that he ran these oil companies, he lived in St. Paul or in Florida. And he would go to Wichita and he would go to Oklahoma, but he really relied on strong people that he would hire to do the work.
He married a lady from here. Their courtship is interesting. He asked her at one point early on in their relationship, can I kiss you? And she said, wait a minute, we're not even engaged. And he said, okay, will you marry me?
And she said, how I caught him.
That's how I caught him. Okay. And later in life, when the money was really pouring in, I think she said to him words to the effect, can't you just earn enough so we can pay the bills? Isn't that enough? And what did he say?
He said, should I just turn off the faucet?
Uh-huh. Well, apparently he didn't. We should say the faucet that poured out all that money was money that I.A. O'Shaughnessy gave to so many educational institutions. And I think most of his giving was in the realm of Catholic education, wasn't it?
Yes. Both higher education and K-12 education here in the Twin Cities.
Well, he certainly had through his own grit and his own brains, by 1934, by one reckoning, he was known as the head of the largest oil refineries owned by an individual in the world. My goodness, just look at that trajectory, how far he came in such a short time. Just amazing.
Yeah.
So he was rolling the money, but he was doing already a notion to do good things for others, right, with his money?
Right. He... there's not much record of his early philanthropy from like the mid-teens until the mid-30s. But then in the late 30s, he decided to become more involved in the life of St. Thomas. His three sons went through St. Thomas Academy, the high school, which then was on the college campus. And he took more of an interest in what was going on there and decided he wanted to get involved and to help them with some facilities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A good guy with a big heart. And, of course, the name of your book, That Great Heart, The Life of I.A. O'Shaughnessy. Where'd you get that title from?
Well, the title comes from the eulogy that one of his best friends, Father Theodore Hesburgh, who was president of Notre Dame from 1952 to 1987, gave at O'Shaughnessy's funeral. And I'll just read briefly from the eulogy. And this is the last paragraph. It said, while we will miss him greatly, those twinkling eyes, that spontaneous smile, that great heart, both we and our lives and our institutions have been enriched by his presence and his great spirit.
Well, that makes for a great book title, That Great Heart. Mm-hmm. That's it. We're talking with Doug Hennis, author of a new book about I.A. O'Shaughnessy, oil man and philanthropist. It's called That Great Heart, just published by, where do we find it? It's all bookstores now, I think, isn't it?
Yes, it's in bookstores, including the bookstore at St. Thomas.
We want to talk to you in just a minute after the break here about where he channeled some of his money, how he helped education, how he helped untold numbers of students, you know, get into education and into careers. Really a remarkable life story here. Doug Hennis and the story of I.A. O'Shaughnessy continues right after this. You want to get your shopping done quickly? Make a list of the people you would like to give to and also write down something they are interested in and take the list to Valley Bookseller and ask them to recommend books for each. The staff will amaze you with the choices you can make. They will even mail them for you. It's Christmas magic at Valley Bookseller. Call 651-430-3385. Great books, great people. 217 Main Street North in Stillwater. They've been sitting on that shelf for years. Those special memories of your childhood on slides, videotapes, or 8mm film. You want to share them, but you don't have a way to do it. Well, now is the time to let Images of the Past do it for you, and you'll have those special memories to share during the holidays. Images of the Past can transfer your memories to DVD to be enjoyed anytime by the whole family. Think of the future, preserve the past. On Main Street in Stillwater at Images of the Past and at imagesofthepast.com.
The Great Northern Union Course is back for their annual Christmas show this Saturday and Sunday. Definitely not your standard chorus. The Great Northern Union Course is an internationally acclaimed 80-plus member all-male a cappella group. Exciting stage choreography and passionate, near-flawless vocals create high-impact harmony up on stage. Don't miss the Great Northern Union Chorus this Saturday and Sunday at the Ames Center in Burnsville. For tickets or more information, send an email to tickets@gnusings.com.
At Jaime's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Jaime's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush. And at prices that won't melt your wallet. Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
We are back exploring the life of, get this name, Ignatius Aloysius O'Shaughnessy. A mouthful and a guy, a great benefactor around these parts and far beyond Minnesota, no doubt about it. O'Shaughnessy, the subject of a brand new book by our guest in studio today. Doug Hennis has written the book. It's That Great Heart, The Life of I.A. O'Shaughnessy. I.A. is a lot easier to say than the other name. And oil man and philanthropist here. It's a fascinating story. Guy born in Stillwater right here back in 1885. Did great things with his money. He was an oil baron. He probably wouldn't like that name, baron, but he was. He was a great big oil mogul and made scads of money, but he did great things with it, Doug. And that's the focus of your book here, That Great Heart you talk about. By World War II, now, again, he was at that point obviously not able to serve except with his money, and in terms of his oil business, I think there's a quote in your book that said, to hell with profits, quote unquote, we have a war to win, huh? So
he was very active in the war effort. He was on several committees, industry committees, as well as committees that were established by the Roosevelt administration to help deal with issues during the war, because there was this insatiable appetite for oil and for gas and for aviation fuel and things like that. And so refiners like him, you know, had to produce, and the bulk of their effort went to the war.
Doug, we were talking during the break, and I'm the product of public schools, and a lot of people, those of us who went to public schools, don't fully realize that in this case of O'Shaughnessy, his great you know, generosity toward the Catholic school systems, especially he was a secondary education, that sort of thing, took the burden, the financial burden off public schools in many ways, because the Catholic school system, as opposed to today, I think was much bigger back in his day. There were more schools, it seems. And so there was a corresponding financial burden that was lifted off public schools because of this wonderful Catholic school system.
That's absolutely correct. He really believed in the formation that he received in Catholic schools, growing up here in Stillwater and then at St. John's and at St. Thomas. And he talked often about what he called the bond of loyalty, that if an institution like a college did for you what it promised to do, and helped you become better educated and advance in your career and in your life, that you had a responsibility to help that institution so other kids could get ahead.
Now, just for the record, the University of St. Thomas, non-Catholics, can they go to school there?
Absolutely.
Right. I thought so. Well,
about on the undergraduate side, about half are Catholic and half are not.
Okay. All right. Well, this man, O'Shaughnessy, my goodness, his reach was so far spread, even to the Vatican. Pope Paul VI knew him well, and I.A. O'Shaughnessy helped out with a dream, fulfilling a dream that the Pope had.
The Pope wanted to develop an ecumenical institute in Jerusalem where religious scholars from around the world could come and study and do research. And so he turned to Father Hesburgh, president of Notre Dame in the mid-60s, and said, help me make this a reality. Mm. Hesburgh said he would get involved in the planning of it, and he in turn went to O'Shaughnessy for the funding. Hesburgh's original estimate was that it would cost between $500,000 and $1 million. This is back in the mid-60s to do this. And in the end, it ended up costing $4.5 million. And O'Shaughnessy paid every penny of it.
My goodness. If you totaled up all the money this man gave O'Shaughnessy to Catholic education and beyond, what would the dollar figure be?
Boy, you know, that's almost impossible to determine. One thing we did look at was, because we had fairly good records at St. Thomas, from the mid-30s until the early 70s when he died, he gave $8.5 million in, you know, for that period of time. But we valued that in 2014 dollars, and it's over $100 million. And St. Thomas was just one of his beneficiaries. It's comparable amount of money went to Notre Dame and other places.
I love that auditorium at St. Catherine in St. Paul. The acoustics are absolutely wonderful. And the name of the auditorium, Doug?
Is O'Shaughnessy Auditorium.
Yes, that would be the one.
They call it the O'Shaughnessy now because they lease it out for outside groups.
Here. And there's an O'Shaughnessy Hall at Notre Dame, I believe, too, isn't there?
There is.
All right, okay. The man's, before we talk about his legacy, and we're quick running out of time here, anything about that? The man was good in just about all ways. Were there any clay in his feet at all? Was he? I mean, we know he was a bit of a rascal as a kid, but what about the rest of it?
Boy, I didn't find any, and I kept on looking. I went through 14 big boxes at the Minnesota History Center alone.
Which no were dirt in there at all.
Jam full of correspondence and stories, and found very little dirt. He could be a little authoritative in his business dealings because he had a lot of refineries to run. But even on the employee front, he was regarded as a very progressive boss.
Unions like him?
Unions liked him. Actually, for the most part, they were never unionized because the employees thought they had a great working relationship. He did things like he instituted annual bonuses, Christmas gifts, pension fund, life insurance coverage, paid vacations, back in a time when that just didn't happen.
Right, amazing. Good husband, good father?
Yep, he had five children. Three boys and two girls, and his youngest son is still alive. Larry lives here in St. Paul.
Okay, all right. One last question. His legacy in a couple of sentences here in a couple of seconds.
Boy, I think his legacy is one that is really still felt today. When I've written a little inscription on the inside of the book, I always say to enjoy the story of a truly remarkable man whose impact is still felt on this community today. And I think that's because of his philanthropy.
Wonderful book, Doug Hennis. Thank you so much for writing it. Thank you for being with us today. And it's grand to see you again, my friend. It's been a long time.
Thank you, Stan.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Happy holidays.
You too. Dougie.
Thank you. Name of the book, once again, That Great Heart, The Life of I.A. O'Shaughnessy, Oil Man and Philanthropist. It's in your bookstore now. Doug Hennis, H-E-N-N-E-S. Great book. Great read. We're coming back with a holiday story you will not forget, I guarantee you, right after this. At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
At Jaime's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Jaime's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Jaime's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush and at prices that won't melt your wallet. Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Jaime's.com.
You finally found it, that old photograph of your grandmother that you've always wanted to share with your grandchildren, but it's torn, cracked, and faded. Well, don't despair. Bring it in to Images of the Past in Stillwater. They specialize in restoring and preserving memories for future generations. So when you bring your old photos to Images of the Past, you can share that beautiful photograph with your grandchildren. You can see examples at klbbradio.com. Keyword, photo. Think of the future, preserve the past. On Main Street in Stillwater at Images of the Past.
Club 1220 KLBB is going to be leaping into the ice-cold waters of White Bear Lake. There on the scene is Jenna and Sarah. Ladies, why would anyone do this act?
We really want to raise money for the Special Olympics and help out our favorite little athlete, Caroline Smith.
And how do people get involved with this activity?
You can give us a call at 651-275-1220 or go to our website at klbbradio.com.
Thank you, ladies. Join KLBB at White Bear Lake. Donate online at klbbradio.com. Brought to you by River Valley Ford.
We are back. It's 12:32 right now. 45 unbelievable degrees here on this date. This being, what do we have here on the calendar? December the 13th. Wow. Well, folks, here we go. We, of course, are in the midst of another holiday season, and for yet another year, this is not a world at peace. As 2014 winds to a close, we look back on too much strife, too much violence, hardship, and sadness. But wait a minute. Imagine the gloom at this time in this nation and the world in mid-December 1941. America had just been thrown into World War II, and soon millions of her sons would be on the fighting fronts around the world, where many nations had already been at war for at least 2 years. Despite the weight of that gloom, there were bright lights of hope, and yes, even some joy during that Yuletide 73 years ago. Nowhere is that glow better seen and felt than in the marvelous story of Christmas at the White House in 1941, America's first wartime Christmas of World War II. Our storyteller here is award-winning author and historian David McCullough. He blends two themes, one brief but poignant moment in history, and the music that provided a backdrop for that moment. It's an amazing story, beautifully told, along with the voices of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Here is In the Dark Streets Shineth.
Music is part of our history. It's an expression of who we are and the times we've known, our highs, our lows, and so much that we love. Take away American music from the American story, and you take away a good part of the soul of the story. It's impossible to imagine life in America without it. Without Shenandoah, or Amazing Grace, or Over the Rainbow, or Oklahoma, or the Battle Hymn of the Republic, or America the Beautiful, or Gershwin, or Copland, or Scott Joplin, or the music of Christmas in America. I would like to tell you the story of a classic American Christmas carol and song, two of my favorites, that both figured in one of the darkest times ever, during the Second World War. Shortly before Christmas, 1941, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, at considerable personal risk, crossed the Atlantic in great secrecy to meet with President Franklin D. Roosevelt. The attack on Pearl Harbor had taken place only weeks before. On Christmas Eve, from a balcony at the White House, the two leaders spoke to a crowd of 20,000 gathered in the twilight. As reported in the Washington Post, a crescent moon hung overhead. To the southward loomed the Washington Monument as the sun dipped behind the Virginia hills. President Roosevelt pressed a button to light the Christmas tree. Then he spoke to the crowd. And by radio, the world was listening. Our strongest weapon in this war, he said, is that conviction of the dignity and brotherhood of man which Christmas Day signifies. Churchill began his remarks. Here he was, he said, far from his own country, far from his family. Yet I cannot truthfully say that I feel far from home. Here in the midst of war, raging, roaring over all the lands and seas, creeping nearer to our hearts and homes, here amid all the tumult, we have tonight the peace of the Spirit in each cottage and every generous heart. Here then, for one night only, should be a brightly lighted island of happiness and peace. The following morning, Christmas Day, the Prime Minister and the President went to church, where with the congregation they joined in singing O Little Town of Bethlehem, which Churchill had never heard before. Beloved of Christmas carols had been written long before by a famous American clergyman, Phillips Brooks, after a visit to the Holy Land. On Christmas Eve at Jerusalem in 1865, Brooks rode through the dark by horseback to the place about town where he was told the shepherds had gathered with their flocks. After returning to his church in Philadelphia, in an effort to put down on paper what he had felt that night, Brooks wrote a poem. Then a few days before Christmas, 1868, he asked the organist of the church, Louis Redner, to put the poem to music that it might be sung at the Christmas service. Redner tried, but with no success. Christmas Eve, he went to bed feeling he had utterly failed. My brain was all confused, he later said, but I was roused from sleep late in the night hearing an angel strain, and seizing a piece of music paper, I jotted down the treble of a tune. Churchill had spoken in his remarks from the White House balcony of every home as a brightly lighted island in the dark. In the first stanza of O Little Town of Bethlehem, is the line, yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light. I like to think of Churchill and Roosevelt singing that line in particular at that time. And as would be said of the Prime Minister, he always sang lustily, if not exactly in tune. With the war still raging, more than 1 million Americans were serving overseas in 65 parts of the world. And it was with those men and women and their families in mind that two talented New Yorkers, lyricist Kim Gannon and composer Walter Kent, went to work on a new Christmas song. Walter Kent had already composed The White Cliffs of Dover, which had become nearly an anthem in Britain. Now they wrote, "I'll be home for Christmas," which in simplest terms expressed the longing for home and light in the darkness felt by so many, so very many. "I'll be home for Christmas. There the love light gleams. I'll be home for Christmas, if only in my dreams." When recorded by Bing Crosby in 1943, it became the most popular holiday song of the time, more even than White Christmas. Just dry dates and statistics. History is human. History can be a great source of strength and affirmation, an aid to navigation, especially in dark and dangerous times. And the words and music we love and that have stood the test of time mean still more when we know their story.
Beautiful story, beautifully told by David McCullough and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. David McCullough has strong memories of World War II. He says, "I was still a boy during the war. I was 11, 12 years old, but old enough to be very aware of what was going on, reading newspapers and knowing that older young men in our neighborhood were away. There were stars in the window and all of that, and it was a vivid part of my whole life." I hope you enjoyed that. That's a very, very, very special story, and as I say, beautifully told, and become a chestnut here on KLBB on this show around the holidays every year. David McCullough mentioned White Christmas in his storytelling there. I'd like to tell you just a little bit about that. The White Christmas that Irving Berlin dreamed of, they were not the earliest ones he used to know. He spent his first five Christmases in Tsarist Russia, and his earliest recollections of that time, at least the only one he'd acknowledge as an adult, was that of watching his neighbors burn his family's house to the ground in a good old-fashioned Jewish pogrom, a Jewish hating pogrom. White Christmas, written by Berlin, is an achingly nostalgic ballad evoking a rural America where, yes, treetops glisten and sleigh bells ring. This was Currier and Ives' country, an idealized winter landscape created for an urban nation that was busily shipping its young men overseas to fight Germany and Japan, the song written in 1941. Amid the unprecedented disruptions of the war, White Christmas, with its implicit assertion that we can somehow get back to this innocent Eden, found a ready audience. Over the subsequent decades, in a world that's only grown more unstable, Irving Berlin's ode has never lost its power. Roughly 2,000 versions have been recorded since Bing Crosby's initial take. The success of White Christmas paved the way for a whole new genre of Christmas songs. Irving Berlin's father had been a cantor, but Berlin left home at the age of 14 to sing in the saloons of the Bowery in New York, and he never looked back. And the religious identity of the composer-lyricist of White Christmas and Easter Parade was as fuzzy as it was perfunctory. A Jew married to an Irish Catholic, Berlin raised his three daughters as nominal Protestants. Who better to write an ecumenical Christmas song? Berlin kept Christmas in the public square in America, and more than anyone before or since, sent it out over the public airwaves. And by the crass index of number of recordings sold and the not-so-crass index of number of spirits touched, Berlin's holiday has been the predominant version of Christmas in this country for the past many decades. You know the words, most of you do, to White Christmas. Here's an instrumental version by the Dutch violinist André Rieu. André Rieu, White Christmas. Instrumental version for you. Yeah, you know the lyrics, and I'll bet you were singing along with it, weren't you? 12:49 right now. Stan Turner with you. Thank you so much here. Just one other couple of tidbits here about the holiday, about Christmas, about maybe this is about the power of Christmas cards and staying in touch with our friends and people we lose track of. A beautiful story written here by a guy named Robert Satter a few years ago, a retired Connecticut Superior Court judge. He wrote this article for the LA Times, and I'll give you just just a piece of it. He writes that while at sea during World War II, I read an essay by the English author E.M. Forster that touched me deeply and to which I have often returned. Collected in a book entitled I Believe, the essay gently expresses Forster's abiding faith in friendship above all, with people he admired most. He said, Forster said, the sensitive, the considerate, the plucky, they are sensitive for others as well as for themselves. They are considerate without being fussy. Their pluck is not swankiness, but the power to endure, and they can take a joke, unquote. While Satter goes on to convey the feeling of kinship among such people, Forster employed the metaphor of single lights scattered on a dark beach, reassuring one another, signaling into the night, well, at all events, I'm still here. How are you? Christmas cards are like those lights, blinking out that same message across the years. And when one flickers out, the darkness deepens. Beautiful thought. Beautiful metaphor indeed there. Mr. Shue, are you ready for a little holiday fun and quiz here in just a bit?
I'm a little terrified.
Don't be.
Before we
plunge into it and we are able to enjoy your brilliance on all this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Just one thing here. This is kind of on the light side and the fun side. According to the Alaska Department of Game and Fish, while both male and female reindeer grow antlers in the summer each year, male reindeer drop their antlers at the beginning of winter, usually late November to mid-December. Female reindeer retain their antlers till after they give birth in the spring. Hmm. Therefore, according to every historical rendition depicting Santa's reindeer, every single one of them, from Rudolph to Blitzen, had to be a girl. We should have known only women would be able to drag a heavy-set guy in a red velvet suit all around the world in one night and not get lost. What do you think about
that? My whole world has literally blown apart. I don't know what to think now. Those claymation Disney shows, they're all wrong.
Well, they're all upside down and inside out. All those reindeer, they're ladies, huh? How about that?
I had no clue.
I love it. Okay. All right, it's quiz time. We'll just have a little fun with this one, Tombo, here. Let's
bring it
go
out.
Here.
Bring
well,
it
this one has kind of a food angle to it. How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the Whos traditionally sat down for a feast of who pudding and who what? Shepherd's pie, pork chops, ham loaf, or roast beast?
Oh, roast beast.
Oh, you got that one right away. You're not going to have any trouble with this. Darn it, you're too smart. Let's see. Let's go on to the next one here.
I love how you butter me up.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. That's a good pun.
Nah.
Candy canes originated in England, France, North Pole, Germany.
Germany.
Yep. Got it again.
Oh,
okay.
Wow, good guess.
In the Christmas Carol, We Wish You a Merry Christmas, carolers are pretty insistent on getting what before they leave? Eggnog? Figgy pudding, hot cider, or cookies?
I'm going to say figgy pudding.
You got it. You said it right. Okay. Well,
I want some figgy pudding. That's
it.
Bring me figgy pudding.
Batting 1,000 so far there, Buckaroo. Ooh. Long before turkey came on the scene, what was the traditional Christmas dinner in the United Kingdom? Reindeer, venison, boar's head, or lamb's tongue?
I'm going to say lamb's tongue.
You missed. Boar's head. Do you believe that? Huh? Boar's
head. I figured lamb's tongue was a little more out there.
Yeah, a little more out there. How about boar's
head? Boar's head's pretty far out there, though, too.
After the show, let's get out and get a nice heaping plate of boar's
head. You know, you can't find a good boar's head around here anymore.
You can't find a good boar. All right. All right. The French Yule log cake is called the Bûche de Noël, a panettone, petit four, or pan forte. Hmm?
Those are questions?
Those are possible answers. The French Yule log cake is called Bûche de Noël. Okay, that's probably an unfair one for you. In the 1983 movie A Christmas Story, the family went out for Chinese food because their neighbor's dogs ate the Christmas what? The crown roast, the turkey, the lasagna, or the ham?
Oh, it was the turkey, no, but I had an advantage. I just saw the Ordway's Christmas Story musical.
All right.
Just a week ago.
All right. Let's take that one off the table, then. That's no fair. Okay. And, folks, you play along with these, too. Which is not a traditional Christmas drink? Wassail, Orangina, eggnog, or glog?
I'm going to say wassail.
Yeah, how about Orangina or Orangina? Okay.
When they say they're going wassailing?
Wassailing, yes. The wassail bowl. Yes, yes.
Okay.
An old English tradition there. In Mexico, Christmas would not be Christmas without what? Tamales, quesadillas, flari, or burritos? flan or burritos?
I'm going to go quesadillas.
Okay. How about tamales? Tamales is the one. Yep, that's the sine qua non right there of Mexican Christmas dinner. Okay. In the holly jolly Christmas, we're told to have a cup of what? Tea, hot chocolate, cheer, or gin?
Oh, cheer.
Okay.
It would be a very different song if it was have a cup of gin.
You got it. Well, you're on a roll, so let's keep going here. Who in Whoville caught the Grinch shoving the Christmas tree and presents up the chimbley? Who?
What's her name?
Go ahead, try.
Oh, gosh, is it Susie or something like that? Now, Sue-who?
You're getting you're really close. Little Cindy Lou Who.
Cindy Lou
Who. Is not more than two. That's who. Isn't that cute? Did Santa Claus ever win an Academy Award?
Did Santa Claus ever win an Academy Award? No.
No? Okay. He did. In 1947, Edmund Gwenn's Santa in Miracle on 34th Street.
That would have been my front-running contender, but I didn't think he quite got it.
Okay, that's okay. Which former railroad telegrapher became Rudolph's all-time best-selling balladeer?
Goodness.
This one, you'll kick yourself if you don't.
Is it Gene?
Which former railroad?
Huh? Gene Autry?
Ah, there you go. You got it.
Yeah.
Good going, man. In what form did the ghost of Christmas yet to come present itself to Ebenezer Scrooge?
A man hooded.
Yes.
Skeleton hands.
Yep, that's
good. You know
good.
What? I watched yesterday. I went out and saw a Klingon Christmas Carol with my buddy, they even had the same kind of thing going on.
Yeah, it was only an outstretched hand protruding from a black hooded shroud, a hand that eventually dissolved into a bedpost. So you did well. You did well on that. Let's see. We have a couple more for you, too, Mr. Shubidoo. Let's see.
I can't believe I'm getting most of these.
Yeah, you're doing well. Let's see. How many days has Hanukkah? Hanukkah begins at sundown this coming Tuesday. How many days has Hanukkah?
Nine. No.
Rethink that one.
It's 10.
Do it again.
Oh, gosh. 8?
15. 8. It is 8.
I knew it was right.
It lasts 8 days. Now, there's a follow-up to that.
Isn't it the 4 on either side and the 1 in the middle?
Okay. How many candles are in the Hanukkah candelabrum?
9.
You got it. Right. Very good. Each Christmas season during his presidency, Franklin Roosevelt wound up in hot water with the Washington, D.C. Fire Department. Why?
I'm going to assume his Christmas tree set on fire.
He and Eleanor insisted on putting lighted candles to decorate their
Christmas
tree.
Traditional German style.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Which I believe I heard you talking
that's
about
right.
just the other week.
That's right, exactly. So that got Roosevelt in Dutch with the D.C. Fire Department.
Don't put real candles on your tree.
Don't do that.
It's a poor decision.
Or keep a really big bucket of sand nearby. But better yet, don't do it at all. Here's one for you, Tom. Which two oceans would you find a Christmas island?
Christmas island. Let's see. That would be Pacific Ocean.
That's right.
And, Indian? I don't know.
You got it. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Did you get a look at this before the show?
I did not.
Okay.
I'm on a roll, sir.
I know you are. Every Christmas, the White House chef creates a gingerbread house for the first family. What was used to pave the driveway of the delicacy baked for President Ronald Reagan?
Oh, not a clue.
Oh, think again. Reagan, what did he like to eat? He always had a jar of jelly beans, right?
Is it really?
Yeah, it is. It is. And let's see. President Rutherford B. How much time? We have time for one more or two?
Yeah, we can do one more.
President Rutherford B. Hayes in 1880 began the custom of giving Christmas gifts to the White House domestic staff. What did each receive?
Oh, gosh. Not a clue. A wreath?
How about a $5 gold piece, which would be worth today? What would you guess? Huh?
A $5 gold piece back then. Let's just say a couple thousand bucks.
A couple thousand bucks. Maybe that's a little high, but I'd take one anyway.
$5?
That's it. That's one of our Christmas programs. We're going to do much the same next week. I'm going to dedicate more music your way, special holiday songs and the stories behind them. Stan Turner here. Thank you so much for your company today. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you, Mr. Hsu. You did beautifully, as always. And what say we get together this coming Monday, right after the news at noon, and do our all requests and dedication program.
Let's make it happen.
It's a deal. You got it. Everybody, have a great weekend. Thank you so much. Happy holidays. Bye-bye.